Welcome to Terra Nova Church. My name is Ed Marcel. I serve as lead pastor here. And today we have a guest who we're welcoming in to speak. And I just want to let everyone know that the topic is a sensitive one. And if you're here with children, parental guidance, like most sermons at Terra Nova, parental guidance suggested this morning. E. Benjamin Skinner was born in Wisconsin, graduated from Wesleyan University. He's reported on diverse topics from five continents for Newsweek International, Travel and Leisure, and other publication. He lives in Brooklyn and has written the book A Crime So Monstrous, which has received great critical acclaim. He was born and raised in Wisconsin and northern Nigeria, where his father served as a British colonial administrator. He first learned about slavery as a child in Quaker meeting houses. The Quakers believe that all men and women are animated by the divine spark of God, and that high view of the image of God in all people led the Quakers to become the first abolitionists. Those two streams of internationalism and Quaker belief wrought a great growth in the vision of Ben Skinner that would create the man that he is today. His Sunday school teachers spent as much time teaching him about Harriet Tubman and William Lloyd Garrison as they did Jesus and Moses. It was 2003, and Ben was on assignment in the Sudan for Newsweek International when he met his first survivor of slavery. He'd flown in stealthily under enemy radar with an evangelical group purporting to buy slaves en masse to secure their freedom, and afterwards hitched a ride on a UN Cessna to the front lines of the North-South Sudanese Civil War. He was 27 at the time and met another 27-year-old. That 27-year-old had spent the majority of his life in bondage as a slave. Ben would begin to be freed up and joyfully bond to the voice of abolition. Though there are more slaves today than ever before, finding them would prove the most daunting challenge in his professional journalistic career. They're hidden in shadows, kept quiet by violent traffickers and masters, and going undercover when necessary, Skinner infiltrated trafficking networks, slave quarries, urban child markets, and illegal brothels. In the process, he became the first person in history to observe the sale of human beings on four continents. We never very easily yield the pulpit, but it is an honor to be able to welcome to our platform journalist, speaker, and abolitionist E. Benjamin Skinner.
Thank you all so much for coming out. It's a beautiful day today to be pondering over the deeds of darkness, and I appreciate it on a Sunday. Typically, on a Sunday, as Ed mentioned, I'd be in Quaker meeting, in which I'd be sitting in a very simple building in silence, and this is a nice contrast, I have to say. We're gonna have church here. Both my Quaker roots and my family roots actually go back to Troy. As early as the 18th century, we can trace our roots. My family right around here. My great 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 grandmother was born in 1791 in Union, which was a Quaker intentional community not far from here. And she believed fervently in the Christianity of Christ. And that term, a great American coined, to contrast with what he called the Christianity of this land at the time. And this individual who coined that term was Frederick Douglass. And my great-great-great-grandmother believed fervently that the Christianity of Christ would never accept slavery as a Bible institution. And so she, along with other Christians of Christ, resisted slavery throughout the 19th century, right up until the Emancipation Proclamation, the Civil War, and the 13th Amendment. And so by the time my grandmother was born, Barbara Irish in 1909. She was actually born right here in Troy, New York. The law and the Christianity of this land had become much more in line with the law and the Christianity of Christ. And when my grandmother was just beginning her life, there was an old black woman here in Troy who was nearing the end of hers. And this woman had been born a slave. And when she was a child, her master had hit her in the head with a metal weight and hit her with such force that it cracked her skull and that it caused hallucinations throughout her life. And she took these hallucinations to be messages from God. She was a devout Christian. And what God told her was to free herself and then to free others. And she followed his word. And throughout her life, she worked at great danger to herself to free hundreds of slaves. She was a conductor on the Underground Railroad, and she never lost a passenger. In addition to that, she resisted the unjust law of this land, the Fugitive Slave Act, in places like Troy. And she took a stand right here in Troy. And we can all be proud that this is where Harriet Tubman made her stand against the unjust law and freed slaves. And yet, today, 100 years after she died, there are more slaves today in the world than at any point in human history. Now, in order for that statistic to mean something, slavery has to mean something. And in common discourse, when we're talking about slavery, we throw it around very easily. Because we assume that with the 300 international treaties, the over a dozen universal conventions banning slavery and the slave trade, we assume that with the 13th Amendment, with the Emancipation Proclamation, that slavery in the old sense, slavery in the sense of slavery as described in Exodus, slavery as this 5,000-year-old institution, is no longer with us. And you look up slavery in the dictionary today, and in Merriam-Webster, the first definition is drudgery or toil. It's become this metaphor for undue hardship. I've got friends who either work or you're up until this week worked in banking, in investment banking, who will say, well, you know, I'm really a slave because yes, I'm paid a six-figure salary, but I'm obliged to work 80 hours a week, and I have this massive mortgage, I can't leave my job, and then, lo and behold, as it turns out this week, they're actually quite disposable as well. That's not slavery. Slavery is also used as a term by well-meaning activists who will talk about the slavery of those who are paid less than minimum wage, who are forced to do, or rather who do degrading work, but are not forced to do that work. And in my definition, those people may be exploited, but if they can walk away, they aren't slaves. So let's be very clear on what we're talking about when we're talking about slavery. Slaves are those forced to work through fraud or under threat of violence for no pay beyond subsistence. And by that definition, there are more slaves in the world today than at any point in human history. Now, where are they? If you were to plot slavery on a map, the vast majority of slaves in the world today would be in South Asia. These are people in some form of debt bondage, in many cases bonded to a debt that they themselves never took. I got to know quite well a man who had been enslaved his entire life in a quarry. He was forced to go and start working there at age 6. He was paying off a debt that his grandfather had taken of the equivalent of 62 cents. And 3 generations and 3 slave masters later, he was forced to work in this quarry by a man that local police knew to be a serial killer. And this man had the power of God over this individual. He was the giver of sustenance, and he was the taker of life. And what he forced this man, who I call Ganu in the book, he asked me to change his name, what he forced Ganu to do, along with the other slaves that he held in this quarry, was make sand by hand, crushing rocks with hammers. And there's only one way that you turn a profit on handmade sand, and that is through sheer, unmitigated slavery. So that's one form. There's another form that many of you will have heard about. This is commercial sex slavery. These are largely women and children who are trafficked, sometimes across international borders, sometimes within their own countries, into places where men will go, and let's be clear, they will rape them. Not just once, twice, sometimes 10 times. Sometimes I encountered women and children who had been raped up to 15 or 16 times in a single day. That form of slavery is the most common if we're talking about international slave trading. Right here in the United States, on average, each year, there are between 14,000 and 17,000 individuals that are taken into slavery right here in the United States. Put another way, if I talk for half an hour, on average, one more person will become a slave right here in the United States, forced to work under threat of violence for no pay beyond subsistence. The numbers are numbing. And when I set out to write this book, I hate to say I took advice from Joseph Stalin. It's oftentimes the worst people that come up with the best quotes. But what Stalin said, and Stalin knew something about mass killing, but what he said was the death of one man is a tragedy, but the death of a million men is a statistic. So I wanted to describe the slavery of one man, of one woman, and of one child. And so I set out to find slaves, to find survivors, and to tell their stories, and to portray their lives in intimate detail. And I also set out to find abolitionists, to find liberators, to parse their motives, and to look at the work that they were doing, what worked and what didn't work. And I went to find traffickers and people that buy and sell and hold human beings in abject bondage. And one of the Quaker ideas is that there is that of God in all of us. And I constantly sought to see that. Sometimes you have to look really, really hard. And I'll give you an example. When I was in an underground brothel in Bucharest, it had taken a while to get to this point. And like most of my work, when I was going undercover, it took ingratiating myself to some folks that you might not be thrilled to have around the dinner table on Sunday. But these were individuals that knew the ground, that knew criminal networks, and had agreed to help me. And some of them agreed to help me because I gave them a little bit of money for their time and translation. Some of them, I believe, honestly wanted to redeem themselves. And one of them, who was a credit card scammer actually, took me and we talked to some drug dealers on the street, and I went in with a translator who was a agriculture PhD student. This was a new line of work for him, but he had the distinct, wonderful skill of being able to speak good English. And we went in, and there was no phatic communication with the trafficker the first time I was meeting him. I said, I want to buy a girl. And at this point, we started negotiating. And he showed me one young woman, and I said, is this the only young woman you have? I'm looking for somebody a little bit younger. She was about 15. And he said that another trafficker said, we have a blonde as well. And the trafficker led us to the second floor of this old burned out mansion. And there we waited, and we heard a scream above us. A third woman came downstairs and said, she doesn't want to come. She's scared. She thinks you're going to hit her. And I said, okay, stop. Before the translation could get through, the woman went back upstairs and we followed her. And we came out on a landing, and from a darkened room, a fourth woman led out, a young woman with bleached hair so that it was sort of rust-colored. And this young woman, in an attempt to, for her, her traffickers had attempted to make her beautiful by putting makeup on her. And she was crying so hard that her mascara had run and her lipstick was smeared beyond the edges of her mouth. And the trafficker held one of her arms so that her shoulder was hunched, and her other arm revealed 10, 15 angry red, some freshly scabbed, deep slashes, where I can only assume that she had attempted to escape the multiple daily rapes the only way that she knew how. And this young woman had the visible effect of Down syndrome. And she was offered to me in trade for a used car. William Lloyd Garrison, writing in the 19th century, said of slavery, "This is an act so unnatural. This is a sin so God-defying. This is a crime so monstrous that it casts into the shade all other distinctions known among man." And it still is. And the sad fact is that you don't have to go very far to find slavery in the world today. As I say, on average, 14,000 to 17,000 slaves are taken into the United States. At any one time, 50,000 are here. Now let's say, for the sake of argument, for the moment, this is the center of the moral universe, right here. We all agree that slavery is not just criminal, but it is an abomination. And if we were to travel some 6 hours, give or take an hour, from where we are, we would be able to negotiate in broad daylight the sale of a healthy boy or a girl. And I was able to do this in broad daylight on the street in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, which is a 3-hour flight from JFK International Airport. I pulled up in a car, and there was a place where everybody in the neighborhood knows where these men stand. There are men standing in front of a barber shop. And by the way, I should little side note here. I made sure that this place was shut down before I published the book, because the one thing I did not want to do was give a roadmap to pedophiles or anybody else. But unfortunately, this network is very large, and just because they're not in this one place, they're elsewhere, and I proved that this summer. But at the time, they were in front of a barbershop, and I pulled up in a car, rolled down the window, and a man came over and said, "Do you want to get a person?" And at this point, we talked at length. And by the way, at this point, I wasn't undercover. I brought out my tape recorder. I said, "I'm a journalist." I didn't actually tell him I was writing about slavery, but I said, "I'm interested in writing about your work." He had no qualms about telling me about his work. The product that he sold was children. The way he put it, however, was that he didn't sell children. He placed them. But the children that he didn't sell went to do one thing, and this is what I was negotiating with him for. I wanted a child who would be a domestic slave, who would cook, who would clean, and he asked all the details. What would they have to be able to cook? How much cleaning experience would you require? Where would they sleep? They would sleep on the floor. How much would you pay them? I wouldn't pay them anything. They would be forced to work under threat of violence for no pay. And I specified that I wanted a 9-year-old girl. And at this point, he leaned in and he said, "You know, this is rather a delicate question, but would you want this child as a partner as well as a domestic slave?" And my translator made it perfectly clear what he meant by partner. And very sadly, this is not unusual for the children, for the 300,000, according to UNICEF estimates, 300,000 children in Haiti that are held as child slaves. They'll be used as what they refer to in Creole as pousa'a, which translates roughly as "there for that." These are not just domestic slaves, they're sex slaves. They, like all slaves, are owned entirely. They can be raped regularly. They can be killed with impunity. 300,000 in Haiti, 3 hours from JFK International Airport. And the asking price for this child was $100. And I negotiated her down to $50. And I had a principle that I stuck to throughout this book. And the principle was developed in concert with the experience of organizations on the ground worldwide that work to free slaves, and we'll talk about those in a moment. One of them, Chab Dai, based in Cambodia, is a fantastic partner of Love 146, which is an organization that we're raising money for here today. I speak regularly on behalf of Free the Slaves, which is another terrific organization that does abolitionist work worldwide. And they implored me during the research, "Do not pay for human life. You're giving rise to a trade in human misery." And so I didn't in this instance, or in any instance. What I did is I went up into the mountains to find families that, against all earthly instinct, had given away their children. And it was quite a journey to get up there. It took about 8 hours, 6 hours from Port-au-Prince down into the southern highlands by tap-tap, the local form of transportation, retrofitted van. And then I took a motorcycle some 2 hours uphill, a dirt bike, over nothing like roads, and then hiked for another 4 hours. And after that day-long journey, I came into a clearing, and I came into a church. which was really nothing like this. It was a few stripped trees, a few rudimentary pews, and a pretty beautiful view of God's creation around us. But the beauty didn't conceal the abject poverty that the families faced. And as I talked to them en masse, there was a sort of group confession that came out. Every single family, save one, had given away a child to a trafficker. And when I asked them why, guilt poured out and desperation. They said, "We could not feed our children. Would you have us watch our children die of a preventable disease rather than give them away to this person that came into our lives?" And this person had held out hope. This person had said, "Mommy, Poppy, I know you can't feed your child. I know you can't treat the malaria that this child is dying of. I will help. I'll buy the medications. I'll feed your child. I'll clothe your child. And I'll send your child to school." And school, for so many of these families, for all of these families, was a luxury that was entirely out of their reach. And food, in many cases, was a luxury that they could scarcely afford. And so, as an alternative to seeing their child slowly wither and die in front of them, they made a devil's choice. And the devil's choice was no choice at all. And they gave their child to a trafficker and an uncertain fate. And at this point, many of them knew where their children had gone. And some of them had learned that their children had gone into slavery and there had been raped, and raped regularly. Imagine the guilt and the pain, particularly of those whose children were still in slavery. And the next morning, a woman came to me named Latan. It was 5:30 in the morning, and I was woken up by her as we slept by the fireside. And she said, "I know where my daughter is. She's in slavery. I need to get her out." And I had taken on a principle when I started writing this book of observing and engaging as little as possible. Primarily observing, but not interfering. My model for writing this book were a couple of excellent books on genocide. One by Samantha Power called A Problem from Hell, another by Philip Gorovitch called We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed Along with Our Families. These books dealt with terrible human problems with sensitivity, but with detachment. And in this moment, and throughout the work thereafter, I realized that the difference between my work and their work is that the victims that they were writing about were no longer with us. The victims that I was writing about were very much alive, and they were suffering. And so I told this woman, "Meet me in a week." And she met me in a week with a community leader. And I came with my accomplice, who was a fixer, and who had the very appropriate, in this case, life experience of serving time in a Georgia state penitentiary. And we went in to a very rough neighborhood, found where this young girl, Latan's daughter, her name was Cam Sees, was being held. And I took Cam Sees out with her mother. And for the first time in 3 years, her mother held her daughter's hand. And I talked to Cam Sees about what she had been through. She was a slave. She was kept out of school. She was beaten regularly. She was called a slave, even by the children of the woman that held her. And when I saw her, she was in shock. And she didn't smile until the very end of the conversation when I asked her what she wanted to be when she grew up. And she at first could only say, I would like to eat, and I want to learn how to read. And I pressed her for a more ambitious goal, and then she smiled and said, I want to be a doctor. And I talked to Latan, and I said, what would keep her free? Because I recognized at this point I'd crossed a line as a journalist, and this was no longer me with my journalist hat on, this was me with my human hat on. And she said, if I could keep her in school, if I could feed her, then I could keep her free. How much would that cost? That would cost $84 per year. $84. It's a little bit more than the price of the child that I had negotiated to buy, but it was eminently more worthwhile an expenditure. And so I said, no problem. Every year that she stays in school, I will fund her school. That was in October. And in December of that year, on Christmas Day, I was in Bihar, India, which is the poorest state in India. And I was in a very rugged, low-technology internet cafe, very slow-moving, and I had three emails. One was from my mother saying, Merry Christmas, and I liked that. Another was from my editor saying, are you still alive? I appreciated that. And the third was from the aid organization through which I had administered this scholarship in Haiti. And this aid organization had sent me a letter, the first that Kamsiz had written in Creole. And they translated it. And Kamsiz signed off the letter by saying, it's me, Kamsiz, your child, who you freed from misery on Delma 34. And that was the only Christmas gift that I got that year, and it was really the only one that I needed. There was also a picture of Kamsiz in her school uniform. And that's Kamsiz. And she is why we fight, why we struggle. Henry David Thoreau, one of my favorite philosophers, 2 days before the outbreak of the Civil War, had written to a friend. And the friend had been reading accounts of slavery and the rumbling disunion, and was very perturbed by it. And Thoreau was torn between pacifism and abolitionism. And at various points, he couldn't reconcile the two. But he knew that they were both important impulses. And he wrote to this friend. And what he said was, if you know of it, you are particeps criminis. You're a partner in the crime. What business have you, if you are an angel of light, to be pondering over the deeds of darkness? And he meant that as an admonition, as a warning, as a caution. I took it, and I take it today, and I hope all of you take it as an exhortation to action. For me, Kamsiz is my angel of light. She's the reason why we do this work. Because this is not an interminable problem. This is a problem that we can end in our lifetime. And fundamentally, these are not disposable people. Somehow, sometimes, some slave men manage to regain their dignity. Some slave women manage to trust men. And some slave children, just for a fleeting moment, manage to be kids and to dream. And that's what Kamsiz did. So the fact of Kamsiz's life and her struggle and her resistance leads me now to take off my journalism hat for a while and to really advocate for all of you to get involved with a fight against these deeds of darkness. And I talk about principally three ways to do this. The first way, fundamentally, is understand what slavery is and get people around you to care about it. The only way that the abolitionists succeeded in abolishing legal slavery in the 19th century was by spreading their word. My great-great-great-grandmother was kind of a freak in the early days. When she was young, the Christianity of the land, along with most people in the land, believed that slavery was ordained by the Bible. They believed that God had made all of us different, and some were made to be slaves and some were made to be free. We don't have to fight that struggle anymore, but we have to recognize that slavery still exists and it's very real. So, concrete steps. Understand what slavery is. Travel if you can, and if you can't, or even if you can, gratuitous plug coming up here, buy the book. Buy other books by Kevin Bales, who's an abolitionist as well, who heads up a group called Free the Slaves, who's the original definer of modern-day slavery, whose estimate, 27 million, is the most widely accepted estimate for the number of slaves in the world today, 27 million, and whose group, Free the Slaves, works regularly not only to free slaves, but to keep them free, to prevent others from entering slavery, and to eradicate bondage. And that's the second major step, supporting groups like Kevin's, like Love 146, and today only, you can buy my book and all proceeds go to Love 146. And what Free the Slaves in particular, because I've worked with Free the Slaves since this book came out to raise awareness and raise funds for them. What they have is a very stripped down organization that makes sure to address the vulnerabilities that lead to slavery and to grow the realization of rights within the communities of slaves and to protect those rights. And what they found is that on average worldwide, and there's a range depending on where they're talking about, what geographic location they're talking about, but on average it costs about $400 to free a slave and to keep them free for the rest of their lives. $400 to bring them up to the moderate poverty level of $2 a day. And if you multiply that out by the total number of slaves, 27 million, that would be about $10 billion, which sounds like a lot of money, until you realize that $10 billion is the cost of the big dig, which leaks in Boston. It's the cost of a month of the war in Iraq. It's a fraction of the cost of so much of what we spend as a government and as a people on consumer items and on government expenditures. And yet, what is it worth? Let's say for a moment that we weren't ginned up. Let's say that this isn't the center of the moral universe. Let's say we're all dismal scientists. If we were to raise those 27 million to the moderate poverty level, they would give back to the economy. Because people on $2 a day actually buy stuff. They contribute to development. They contribute to the economy. So they would give back to the global economy some $22 billion. That's more than a twofold increase in the return on investment. So let's say that we weren't motivated by the morality of this. Let's say that we are motivated only by the narrow economic vision of what development does for all of us. This is a good deal. It's a good investment. So working to support groups like Free the Slaves and their British sister organization, which is Anti-Slavery International, the oldest human rights organization in the world, is a great second step. And a third step, particularly right now, in this election year, we need national leaders and local leaders to understand that this is a priority. The question today is not whether slavery is wrong. We all agree that it is. The question is how high in your inbox it is and what you're going to do about it. And at the moment, there is a fight going on. It's not much of a fight, actually. It's more a question of getting Congress to move, which, as we all know, can be sometimes quite difficult. But there is a bill sponsored by Senators Joe Biden and Sam Brownback called the William Wilberforce Trafficking Victims Protection Reauthorization Act. And this bill, at the moment, has passed out of committee, and if it comes to the floor, it will pass. The question is whether it'll come to the floor, and it won't come to the floor unless all of us speak out, unless we write to Senators Clinton and Senator Schumer and everybody that we know in the Senate and say, this is something we care about. Essentially, what this bill does is it reestablishes our duty as a country to free slaves at home through the Justice Department and through other means, and to free slaves abroad through international, through our development programs, but also through State Department pressure by going to other countries and saying, do your job, fulfill your responsibilities, and free slaves. It's a very specific law. It's an imperfect law. There's no such thing as a perfect law, but it's a good law, and it's worth our support. So with those three steps in mind, I give to you the opportunity to be an abolitionist. And this is something that I rarely call myself that, but I was so flattered when Ed introduced me with that designation. I think of abolitionists as being those like Harriet Tubman, who, when she lay dying here in Troy, shortly after my grandmother was born, she said to the assembled room, I go to prepare a place for you. And the time to finish her work is now, and the place is here. Thank you very much.
Ben, we're very grateful to be able to call you an abolitionist because you heard a call, which I think was a pay grade promotion from journalists, and we're very glad that you accepted that. Thank you for being here today with us. There have been echoes in what we've discussed today, from the original abolitionists to Harriet Tubman's quotation of the words of Christ, that I go to prepare a place for you. The idea that there is a spark of the divine in people definitely is in this movement. I want to take just a brief moment to point us towards the words of Jesus that give us some direction in how we can act upon everything that has moved in our heart and mind today. And I genuinely sense that many people are moved and hope that it continues to action. There's a religious man who probably came to gatherings not unlike this, who came to Jesus and asked, what do I do to do the right things in this world to have eternal life? And Jesus said to him, what is written in the law? How do you read it? And the man answered, you shall love the Lord with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind and strength, and your neighbor as yourself. He said, that's the right answer. And the man had a follow-up question, didn't have a moderator at the mic, and his follow-up question was, who's my neighbor? And it says the man asked it in an attempt to justify himself. He wanted to be able to figure out how he could just take care of his own and maybe even skirt some of the obligation. And Jesus, as the Christianity of Christ looked like, didn't give him a denomination to go to. He didn't give him a theological creed to recite. He gave him a story. And he said there was a man going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he fell among robbers who stripped him and beat him and departed, leaving him half dead. Now, by chance, a priest was going down that road, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. So likewise, a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, he passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he journeyed, came where he was, and when he saw him, he had compassion. He went to him, bound up his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he set him on his own animal and brought him to an inn, took care of him. And the next day he took out 2 denarii, gave them to the innkeeper, saying, "Take care of him, and whatever more you spend, I will repay you when I come back." Which of these 3 do you think proved to be a neighbor to the man who fell among the robbers? He said, "The one who showed mercy." And Jesus said to him, "You go and do likewise." Today you're part of a story. It's a story of a man who looked at things which we would rather not see and stood before us as a witness, as a voice crying in the wilderness in a wicked world. And in that story, I believe that spark within us will ask, who in that crowd did right to their neighbor when they heard that man speak? And the answer will be the same as it was as Jesus stood in Palestine, the one who showed mercy. The Samaritan who was looked down on for being wrong in his religious views by the people of his day, for being of a mixed race that was not as acceptable as others, is the hero, not the priest who was busy with religious duties and accepted only that and walked away, not the Levite who likewise had religious status but walked away, but a man who did 6 things. This man went. He saw and he crossed the road to him. You need to be men and women who will go. He gave, he bound the wounds and gave oil and wine and aid to this person. He carried the burden. He put him on his own animal, his own resources to carry. These men, women, and children who are trafficked need you to carry their weight. They cannot do it. He brought the man to an inn. He connected him to resources that would help in his healing and protection. He took care of him. He stayed. He put his daytimer on hold and stayed the night in that inn to secure that this man was all right. And then he left more. He took from his own prosperity and he gave it and said, "Whatever it costs, I'll give it so that this person is taken care of." Today there are going to be some chances just immediately to connect. We connect with Love 146. You've heard a lot about Free the Slaves, 2 great organizations. On our webpage, we're going to link a video by Love 146 that we took out of the service today so we could give you more time to ask questions. And you can go to terranovachurch.org and look at that. The proceeds from the sale of the book today will go to Love 146. There's also a chance to give beyond that, that will be at the same table to give to Love 146. And we'd encourage you to do that, too. If you can be generous, make that donation. Band's going to come back up. And we're going to come to a time that is recognized in different Christian denominations by different names. Some call it Eucharist, meaning Thanksgiving, that we're really grateful that while we were lost and in bondage to sin, God came for us. Some call it communion, that we draw closer to God and closer to one another by moving to him as that fixed objective point of truth, that no matter where we're coming from, we can commune by moving ever closer to him. When I was in seminary and in church today, there's often a discussion about who Jesus is. And some of us want to take parts and almost have a line item veto of perspective. And there are those who really like the social activist Jesus. And they want to follow the moral example that he gave and say, "Well, I want to resist evil to the point of sacrifice and doing good." And there are some who, while ignoring that side, will move to another side of the spectrum. And they'll say, I see the sacrifice Jesus, the theological Jesus, the substitute Jesus for my sin. And they'll want to stay in that. I'd encourage you, it's both of those streams. that to be one who follows after this one is to recognize him in his fullness as you can possibly see him in your humanity. And as we come, we see the one who sacrificed, and we see the one who gave the moral example, and we seek to follow him. We don't own communion as a denomination, and so we invite anyone who can see Jesus as those things to come forward in this time. People will be holding the matzah and wine and juice, and you can take and dip. There'll be two songs for you to really be able to pray and meditate towards. In honoring Ben's Quaker roots and in honoring you being able to pray, we're going to take about 30 seconds of silence and give you a chance to commune with God on this issue. And I'd encourage you to empty your heart before him, and also encourage you in that silence not just to be the one doing the talking, but to hear from him as he speaks to you. Lord, we thank you that you are the one who came to seek and to save that which was lost. Help us to do likewise. Amen.